Welcome to Native Sun on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Our first story is Healed Healers Heal, Inside the Push for an Indigenous Medical School by Elise Wild for Native News Online. A first-of-its-kind medical school could transform healthcare in Indian country for the better. The Indigenous School of Medicine, ISOM, a proposed medical school that weaves ceremony, culture, and Indigenous practices into physician education, could welcome students as early as 2030. Dr. Donald Warren, Ogallala Sioux, physician and co-director for the Center of Indigenous Health at Johns Hopkins and ISOM president, told Native News Online that the school aims to provide an environment where students don't have to check their indigeneity at the door, but instead center their education and practice around their culture. The school could not only increase the number of Native American physicians, only 0.3% of practicing physicians are American Indian or Alaska Native, but would also create a space in medical academia for Native people. A big challenge in medical education is that we have zero medical school deans who are American Indian, Warren said. We're not underrepresented, we're unrepresented. We talked to Warren about creating a curriculum that leaves medical students healed instead of exhausted, the omnipresence of Indigenous medicine in healthcare, and why culture is critical to care in Indian country. The questions have been edited for length and clarity. Question: when we use the word Indigenous with medicine, society tends to automatically categorize it as anecdotal, not evidence-based, or simply a nice add-on. We know that isn't the case, though. There is a wealth of evidence attesting to the efficacy of Indigenous medicine and culturally centered care. All that being said, what would distinguish an Indigenous medical school from a typical medical school? Answer: a lot of our American Indian and Alaska Native students have the sense that they need to check their culture at the door in order to fit into the culture of modern medicine, and it is really a shame. Another big challenge in medical education is that we have zero medical school deans who are American Indian. We're not underrepresented, we're unrepresented. Deans are the chief executive officers of a medical school, and we're not at those tables. We're not involved in curriculum development. We're not involved in student wellness as American Indian people. So we're relying on the non-Indian world to train our students. Something like 1 in 1,000 tenured medical professors is American Indian. What would distinguish an Indigenous school is the incorporation of traditional Indigenous medicine into the curriculum. There's also a huge misunderstanding of how much Indigenous medical science has already contributed to the field. For example, even aspirin is willow bark tea. When you go to the ER and they suspect a heart attack, the first thing they give you is willow bark tea in the form of aspirin. That's our medicine. It's been our medicine for thousands of years. There are actually hundreds of examples of Indigenous medicine that have been incorporated into modern medicine. Question: you mentioned Native students feeling like they need to check their culture at the door. What was your own experience with that in medical school? Answer: I wear my hair in a traditional way, and there were even comments about that. I started medical school in 1990, so that's 36 years ago. Things have improved since then, but there's still a lot of work to do. There's this whole concept of education by humiliation, the idea that fear is a great motivator. If you get something wrong, you can be belittled and berated in front of your fellow students, and it's very traumatizing. I went to Stanford for medical school, and one of the attending physicians said I had to suffer, so you will too. We already face high dropout rates from high school and lower college completion rates among Native students, so we have fewer potential pre-meds to begin with. And unfortunately, even in medical school, American Indian students have the highest dropout rate. It's a travesty to get that far and not finish. The Association of American Medical Colleges has what's called a graduate questionnaire, and in some years, as many as a quarter of the graduates already regret going into medicine because of the way they were trained. That's our future workforce. The way we're doing it is wrong. We shouldn't be graduating traumatized scientists. We need healed healers. The tagline for ISOM, the Indigenous School of Medicine, is healed healers heal. In our curriculum, we'll incorporate wellness, culture, and ceremony. We'll focus on producing healed healers who can provide higher quality care. When you think about it, the provider's health and balance directly affects how they interact with their patients. Question: who can apply to ISOM? Answer: this school is open to anyone. You do not have to be an Indigenous person, but you do have to have demonstrated commitment to Indigenous health. If we have allies who are committed to working with our people, they are welcome. My sense is that the majority of applicants will probably be Indigenous, but we welcome allies as long as they are truly committed to working with Native communities. Question: where does the feasibility study currently stand, and where might the school be located? Answer: we received a $1 million grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to conduct a feasibility study, business plan, and economic impact assessment. We've had discussions with several cities: Rapid City, South Dakota, Anchorage, Alaska, Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Flagstaff, Arizona. By far, the greatest support has been in Rapid City. We have letters of support from the mayor, from the CEO of Monument Health, from the Dean of the University of South Dakota Medical School, and from the presidents of South Dakota State University and South Dakota School of Mines and Technology, and from the large tribal clinic in Rapid City. The political, academic, economic, and health system support is tremendous. Our business plan will be complete by the end of July, and then we move into fundraising. ISOM will be a nonprofit medical school, so we'll depend on fundraising and large-scale endowments. Question: we know there are massive health disparities in Indian country, driven by many factors. How could ISOM close those gaps? Answer: many of the health disparities we deal with are preventable. One of the big missing pieces is Indigenous-focused medical education, in which our providers are healthy and balanced, culturally sensitive and humble, and can work effectively with our people. If we have higher quality care and access to more services, we will see those disparities improve. The long-term goal, 7 generations from now, is to have no disparities, to have equitable health for all populations. That's the dream our future generations will live out. Up next, American Prairie Conservation Groups appeal bison grazing decision. By Micah Drew for the Daily Montanan. Earlier this year, the Coalition of Large Tribes protested BLM's proposed decision, saying the new definition of livestock would impact tribal bison herds and any related bison co-stewardship or surplus programs. American Prairie and other conservation organizations have filed appeals in the federal government's decision to terminate bison grazing leases on the Bureau of Land Management parcels in Montana. As a result of the lease cancellations, American Prairie has halted an annual bison harvest program, which would have issued 17 hunting permits to members of the public this year, and tribal nations argue it will have a negative impact on food sovereignty programs. The BLM issued its final decision in early May, canceling all 7 bison grazing permits for American Prairie, with a September deadline to remove its herds from federal land. On June 4th, American Prairie filed its appeal with the Department of the Interior, and the week of June 8th, conservation organizations, Defender of Wildlife, and the Western Watershed Project also filed appeals. BLM's new interpretation has no basis in law and contradicts its own findings, said Pete Frost, attorney at the Western Environmental Law Center representing Western Watersheds. BLM reversed itself due to politics, not the law, nor the need to restore prairie grasslands. American Prairie is a nonprofit dedicated to conserving prairie land in Montana and manages more than 500,000 acres between private holdings and leased land. The organization also has a focus on species restoration, including bison, the national animal. The organization has around 900 animals in its herds and has been grazing them under BLM authorization with some leased acreage stretching back two decades. But over the last few years, with appeals filed during the Biden administration, Montana officials have argued bison grazing is a risk to Montana's ranching community. Montana, along with the Montana Stock Growers Association and other livestock groups, appealed a 2022 decision that authorized the American prairie bison grazing leases, which had followed nearly 3 years of public scoping and environmental analysis by the Bureau. Under the Trump administration, direct appeals from Montana Governor Greg Gianforte, Attorney General Austin Knutson, and the state's congressional delegation saw a response from Interior Secretary Doug Burgum, who assumed jurisdiction of the case dealing with American prairies grazing rights. Conservation groups have said the decision to terminate those leases is political at its core. Western Watersheds, in a press release, cited reports by Public Domain, pointing out Karen Budd Phelan, now the third-ranking official in the Interior Department, represented some ranching groups in the appeal of the original 2022 decision allowing bison grazing. Montana officials, on the other hand, argue grazing bison doesn't fit the purpose of those federal lands, and working lands should support ranching families who help feed the country. Bison productivity requirement. In the May decision canceling the leases, the BLM focused on a 1934 Taylor Grazing Act, the legal framework that governs leases on federal lands. Using a new definition of livestock, the decision states that grazing permits are limited to cases where the animals will be used for production-oriented purposes. But American Prairie argues it has contributed hundreds of bison to tribal food sovereignty programs, supplied bison as breeding stock to grow bison herds for meat production and economic benefits, and allow the public to harvest hundreds of bison for meat consumption, arguments that the BLM so far has rejected. The agency overturned American Prairie's grazing permits on unrelated factors, the organization's conservation goals, management purpose, and intent, the appeal states. In other words, BLM set up one standard based on the animal's use, then ignoring American Prairie's strong evidence meeting the standard, the agency arbitrarily denied the permits on an entirely different basis. American Prairie notes the cancellation of hunting permits means a loss of $25,000, but the impacts of the new livestock definition could ripple past American Prairie's lease holdings with multiple tribal nations, concerned it could limit their own ability to manage bison herds. Earlier this year, the Coalition of Large Tribes, a group representing more than 50 Native American tribes, protested BLM's proposed decision, saying the new definition of livestock would impact tribal bison herds and any related bison stewardship or surplus programs. The decision as written makes it unlikely that any tribal government or tribal citizen buffalo herd could ever be eligible for BLM grazing leases, the coalition wrote in its protest. According to American Prairie, the organization has supplied 645 bison to entities in 8 states plus Washington, D.C., including shipping bison to 9 tribal nations, 5 in Montana. These animals are going to local tribes for their food sovereignty, said Shamois Anderson with Defenders of Wildlife. What an incredible opportunity to be managing the bison resource ecologically for Native nations to have the benefit. The opportunity to graze on public land should not be exclusive to cattle. They're not Native. It should be open to our Native grazer, bison, Anderson said in an interview with the Daily Montanan. They in fact have more ecological benefits to habitat restoration, which BLM is supposed to do, not just provide forage for bovine cattle, but that the animal is contributing to the health of rangelands. According to a 2025 BLM infographic about the agency's grazing program, there are 41 grazing permits for bison issued by the Bureau across the country, alongside 18,000 permits and leases overall. When the decision to rescind the grazing leases was announced, Montana's elected officials praised the federal government for prioritizing Montana ranchers over an ideological experiment. This final decision is a victory for the rule of law and the generations of Montanans who have stewarded our lands with care, Geofort said. You're listening to Native Son on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. In our next story, Native children belong in Native communities. Tribes decry New Mexico drug-exposed newborn rule. Groups say new directive fails to respect Native sovereignty amid complicated history of indigenous child removals, as found in The Guardian. One morning last July, Micah Bizzini arrived at work to an onslaught of messages from confused families. New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham had just issued a directive mandating the state's Child Welfare Department seek custody of all newborns who had been exposed to drugs and alcohol in utero. Some parents wondered whether medications that they were taking for addiction recovery, such as methadone, would flag their cases. Healthcare providers wondered whether the fentanyl in an epidural counted as drug exposure. Bizzini supports families as a policy manager at the nonprofit organization Bold Futures, which advocates for policies that keep families together. Research shows that children prenatally exposed to substances do best when they can remain in their family and receive supportive services to treat any withdrawal symptoms they experience. Bizzini is also a member of the Navajo Nation, and she immediately noticed that the new directive appeared to be in tension with laws protecting the sovereignty of New Mexico's Native tribes. Those laws stipulate that tribes must be immediately notified about a child welfare case involving a Native child so that they can take jurisdiction of cases involving their citizens. How are we notifying families, tribes, nations, pueblos? She wondered. The directive erodes important procedural safeguards for Indian families. The ACLU wrote in an emergency petition it filed with New Mexico's Supreme Court last month, noting that it makes no reference to specific procedures and safeguards for Indian children and families established in state and federal law. Nine tribes signed on to the lawsuit. Although the state Supreme Court declined to pause the governor's mandate in early June, it will allow arguments on the case to proceed. The new directive also directly contradicted a law the state legislature had passed only months prior, directing the state's health care authority, rather than its child welfare agency, to develop new rules for treating drug use during pregnancy. As states across the country have navigated the fallout of the opioid epidemic, they have struggled with how best to serve babies exposed to drugs during pregnancy. Medical professionals advocate keeping families together to prevent the stress of a traumatic separation and encourage parents to seek care rather than fearing punishment. Lawmakers, on the other hand, motivated by stories of kids being harmed, have moved to take children into custody. This dilemma is particularly acute when it comes to Native families, given the complicated history of Indigenous children being removed from their homes. The Federal Indian Child Welfare Act requires states make effort to keep Native children in Native communities. A growing number of states, including New Mexico, have adopted state law to strengthen their compliance with ICWA. But in New Mexico, at least 25 Native children have been flagged by child welfare since the governor's directive went into effect, with tribes taking jurisdiction in only 10 of those cases. New Mexico is navigating a new policy that has brought the issue back into the spotlight, but advocates say states across the country have long implemented the law haphazardly. I don't think there's any state that is in what I would call really substantive compliance with the Indian Child Welfare Act, and New Mexico's no different, said David Simmons, Director of Governmental Affairs and Advocacy at the National Indian Child Welfare Association. There were no resources. Tribes are still fighting to fund culturally grounded child welfare programs a decade after Congress passed the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act, the leading federal response to the opioid epidemic, which included guidelines for supporting families whose children have been exposed to drugs during pregnancy. Under CARA, State child welfare agencies were directed to support families by developing voluntary plans of safe care, connecting parents to resources to support newborns exposed to substances. The law also required states to abide by the 1978 Indian Child Welfare Act, passed in the aftermath of the mass separation of Native American families in the 19th and 20th centuries, which gives tribal governments jurisdiction over child welfare cases involving Native children. But CARA is approaching its 10th anniversary in July, and addiction and overdose rates across the country remain high. Although overdose deaths have fallen from their 2022 peak of more than 100,000, they remain at nearly 80,000 in 2024, the most recent year for which data is available. And Native Americans continue to be disproportionately affected, according to the highest overdose rates by race at 51.6% per 100,000 in 2024. New Mexico has consistently reported among the highest rates of substance abuse and substance-exposed newborns in the nation, more than one-third of the infants in the United States between 2016 and 2019 were found to be exposed to drugs, alcohol, or tobacco. Yet advocates say CLARA has never been properly implemented to address the problem. When New Mexico implemented a state version of the federal law last year, it did not allocate any state funds to the policy change and remains grossly understaffed on public mental services. Even if families were accepting plans of care, there are no resources, said Bitsini. 10 years later, it's difficult to quantify how successful CARA was, in no small part due to the surge in opioid overdose deaths spurred by the COVID pandemic and the continuing nationwide shortage of mental health providers. After two children in New Mexico died of substance abuse, political pressure mounted, ultimately prompting Lujan Grisham's 2025 directive, which disposed of the voluntary protocol. As of last month, 137 newborns had been taken into state custody under the governor's directive, according to the New Mexico CYFD spokesperson Jake Thompson. While the Navajo Nation supports the intent of the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act to provide supportive family-centered services, we have significant concerns that the proposed rule does not align with the federal and state protections, including the Indian Child Welfare Act and the New Mexico Indian Family Protection Act, Navajo Nation President Boo Nygren wrote in an April letter. Additionally, the news raises serious issues related to tribal customs, sovereignty, jurisdiction, and the potential for unnecessary child welfare system involvement. Doralyn Lorenzo, who is from Acoma Pueblo and previously directed the Office of Tribal Affairs at the state's Children and Youth Families Department, worries the policy was written without consulting tribal nations. Child welfare could do well to learn from the values of our tribe, she said, who noted the wide community of state, tribal, and child welfare advocates who joined forces on drafting the state's ICWA law passed in 2022. Safe children are created within safe communities. Cynthia Chavez, a member of the Lumbee tribe, previously served as the field deputy director for New Mexico's Protective Services Division and the tribal liaison for CYFD. She says the governor's directive harkens back to a time before ICWA, when Native children were separated from their families en masse. Between 1860 and the mid-1970s, hundreds of thousands of Native American children were sent to residential boarding schools intended to assimilate them, where at least 1,000 children died. In the 1950s and 60s, the U.S. government implemented a second program called the Indian Adoption Program, which placed hundreds of indigenous children in white families. I feel very strongly about stopping the genocide of our people by the continuous stealing of our children, said Chavez. Native children belong in Native communities. In our final story, Native Nations Baseball Tournament brings Indigenous youth athletes together for national competition by Native News Online staff. Native American youth baseball players from across the Southwest and beyond are gathering at Salt River Fields at Talking Stick this weekend for Native Nations 16U National Baseball Tournament, an event that blends elite athletic competition with Indigenous culture, community, and youth development. The four-day tournament features 11 teams representing tribal and Indigenous communities competing for a national championship and a berth in the prestigious Babe Ruth World Series, hosted by the same complex used by Major League Baseball teams during spring training. The tournament aims to elevate the visibility of Indigenous athletes while bringing together families, tribal leaders, Native-owned businesses, artists, and community organizations. Native Nations was created to ensure Native youth have access to the same opportunities as any other athlete while celebrating who they are and where they come from, said DJ Carrasco, founder and executive director. This event is about so much more than baseball. It's about representation, visibility, culture, and creating opportunities that many Native youth have not had access to before. Carrasco, a former Major League Baseball pitcher, founded the organization after spending more than 15 years in professional baseball. Drafted by the Baltimore Orioles in the 26th round of the 1997 Major League Baseball Draft, he played professionally from 1997 through 2012, including stints with the Kansas City Royals, Chicago White Sox, Pittsburgh Pirates, Arizona Diamondbacks, and New York Mets. Today, he has redirected that experience toward creating opportunities for Indigenous youth through sports. Growing up, I rarely saw Native players represented in professional baseball, Carrasco said. Native Nations is about changing that narrative. We want Native youth to know they belong in this game. They can compete at the highest levels, and they never have to leave their culture behind to pursue their dreams. The tournament extends beyond the baseball diamond by intentionally incorporating Native culture and community into the event. Throughout the weekend, attendees can support Native-owned vendors, artists, food businesses, jewelers, and entrepreneurs, creating an atmosphere that reflects the diverse communities represented by participating teams. Native Nations also emphasizes youth wellness through its Home Plate initiative, which integrates healthy snacks, hydration stations, wellness education, leadership development, and lifestyle resources into the tournament programming. We're not just developing athletes. We're helping to develop healthy, confident young people, Carrasco said. Home Plate reflects our belief that athletic success, wellness, culture, and community are all interconnected. Families who attended last year's inaugural tournament described it as more than a sporting event, emphasizing its sense of community and accessibility. It was the first time his grandpa was able to see his grandson play because Native Nations made it affordable, one family shared. Another reflected on the atmosphere, saying, "We felt like we were on the res, a big community with our own food, jewelry, and energy." These experiences align with the organization's broader mission of ensuring Indigenous athletes have access to the same opportunities, exposure, and resources as their peers, while remaining connected to their cultures, families, and communities. You've been listening to Native Sun on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Music is Land Back by Hallucination. Remember, you can always get Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Please join us next time for an upcoming episode.